Hello, everybody. Welcome to podcast number 57 of the Alexi Sale podcast. And it's just me and Talal here today at Alexi Sale Towers, or I don't know, whatever fictional domicile you want to imagine we live in, me and him, Alexi Sale Caravan.
It's the penthouse of a Premier Inn, isn't it? Remember?
Is it?
Yeah, that was your castle. If you were the supreme ruler,
yeah,
we would have a Premier Inn and you'd live in the penthouse.
Funnily enough, I don't know if I said when I was making Indiana Jones and Last Crusade, the Sean Connery was moved because people were bothering him. He was actually staying at our hotel. I think he gave up in the end and moved back to his house near Marbella. But they put him on the there was a sort of penthouse on the roof of the hotel with a swimming pool, kind of, and he was put up there with an armed guard, a guy with a rifle, I seem to remember.
Oh, my God.
Because he was getting so bothered by really rude German tourists. Why will you not sign my book for my son? Why should you? Why should I let you eat your breakfast?
Fuck off.
Yeah, fuck off. Fuck off.
Trying to eat my kippah.
I don't think they did kippah at the, what was it called, the hotel? The Playa, was that Playa Dulce, was it? Was the rest, I can't remember what the resort
town
was called. Either the town or the restaurant was called, maybe the resort was called Playa Dulce, I can't remember, Sweet Beach. Maybe the hotel was called Playa something or other.
Some of Indy was shot in Germany.
In Spain.
Spain. Why was there German?
The German tourists.
Okay, yeah. A lot of Indiana Jones was shot in Spain.
Southern Spain, yeah.
Kind of like, is that like the deserty kind of?
Yeah, exactly. All the stuff with the tank and all that is shot up in.
Whoa.
Above Mini Hollywood and above Almeria.
Speaking of, I might as well bring it up now. Our previous guest, Ellen E. Jones.
Yes.
Has a show on Radio 4 and on BBC Sounds called Screenshot with Mark Kermode.
Yes.
20 grand for a Kazi. Kermode. And they did episode on archaeology. It's either the current episode as you're listening or the one before that. And you were a guest on that talking about Indiana Jones.
Yes. Go on.
You gave us a shout out. You gave a shout out to the podcast and to me.
Getting professional at the age of 72. We were talking about the white guys playing Arabs.
I've actually got a clip. Can I play it?
Yeah, go on.
So he's asking you about your character, the Sultan of
Iskandarun,
which is basically, he's basically an Arab character, yeah? And he's asking you about playing him. Here we go. Yeah. This is Kermode and Sale.
Because you're a man who thinks a lot about the politics of things, what's the politics of playing the Sultan? Could you do it now?
No. You know, my podcast, I do it with this young Syrian man, and I was railing about how Indy's best friend, the Egyptian Salim, I think he's called, is actually played by a Welshman. Talal, my sidekick, pointed out that, but so are you. You're a fraud as well. You're from Liverpool. I was offered the role of, in The Mummy, the first Mummy film. The character was called something like Slimy Arab Number One. I said at that point, I can't do this. You know, for many reasons, this is wrong, really. And Omid did it. People say, who would play you in the movie Your Life? I say Omid Jalili.
Another previous guest.
He's not an Arab, but he's Iranian. But, I mean, he worked with the writers and the director to make it a much less stereotypical character. But, no, I think I wouldn't do that role now. Because, anyway, I can explain that my character is actually an Ashkenazi Jew via a kind of accident of geography.
No.
No. I guess I'd have to say no.
Alexi Sale.
Yeah. Love that. Yeah.
Yeah, it was all right, wasn't it?
How was that experience for you?
Yeah, it was nice. I just cycled into a studio in the West End and did it. I was sorry that Ellen wasn't there. I thought she might be, but she wasn't. So it'd be nice to meet her in person. But it was fine, really. I mean, it's I don't know how long is the rest of my contribution. Is that
was about maybe a fifth of it, a quarter of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and then a 5-minute segment.
Yeah.
No, very nice. And you, I remember when, because Ellen reached out to me and said, can we get Alexi to do this? And you're like, you weren't sure what you could contribute to the topic of archaeology.
Yeah. Well,
but
no.
I think they just use that as kind of a landing point and they just have cinematic conversation.
Yeah. No, it's not my favorite topic to talk about, but it was, it's fine.
That comment you made at the end about, is there a way I could excuse him as an Ashkenazi Jew has found himself? Yeah. Was that a commentary on Israel, on Zionism?
No, it's just
how all these.
The inappropriate. Well, no, it's just me.
Very nicely done. Nicely played on that. You can find that, listeners, on BBC Sounds, I think, and they probably play repeats on Radio 4, but that Screenshot is the name of the show.
And also this week, what day is it? It's Thursday as we're recording this thing. This week, in a surprise change of schedule, my Richard Osmond House of Games has been going out all week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, it's 6 p.m. on BBC Two.
Well, how many episodes? Is that a repeat or is that? Oh, yeah. Wow.
No, you do every day. You record 5 episodes. And that's, I think, a wonder whether there was a, it wasn't supposed to be me. It was supposed to be 4 different people. But I wonder whether there was a question about One Direction or something like that. So they had to switch it at the last minute because it went out. It wasn't. In a change to our, previously announced schedule, this week's Richard Osman's House of Games will feature Alexi Sale, Emma Siddy, Anthony Costa.
Because of the sad death of Liam Payne.
Yeah, they didn't say that. None of the other contestants from the dropped episode, there was none of the other contestants that would have been mired in controversy. So it couldn't have been that, I think. It must have been a question, you know.
Yeah. Well, some people on Twitter had noticed that the lineup was different to the scheduling. Yeah. And that explains it, perhaps. And someone reached out on Instagram and asked, actually, they said, on Instagram, so watching Alexi on House of Games, did you enjoy filming it? What was that like?
I did tremendously. And it was, we had a right laugh on the train going back, me and Emma Siddy and Anthony Costa from Blue. We were just laughing our heads off, really. Anthony's a very engaging character. And and I also enjoyed shooting it. And it made me think in a way, I mean, at that point, shot it a few months ago. At that point, I don't know, I'd been very much involved. You know, it was, I think, in the run-up to the election. Yes, it was just before the election. And I just thought, I'd forgotten how nice people in show business are, by and large. Just how love, just the sort of esprit de corps there was amongst. I mean, you can get a kind of, you know, obviously somebody who's difficult. But, those 4 people were so sweet and supportive, you know. And as people in show business, by and large, are really. And I just thought, compared to the world of politics, where, you know, the default position, not obviously on our side, not our people, but everybody else is so hateful. You know, they all hate each other. They hate themselves. And because they're engaged in evil, I think. I mean, it's not just the Tories, but obviously the right wing of the Labour Party. They're such vile people, you know, and you just to be amongst them, it's like, I felt this warm glow of love for the entertainment business, really, and I thought, why can't I do more stuff like that, really? And I come across, I think, I'm very critical of my own work, but I come across as very, I'm good at that. I'm very genial on that show. I've watched, me and Linda have watched, I think we watch Monday and Tuesdays live. And, I come across as a genial old gent, really. People don't, I keep the anti-capitalist hate button down, you know. I just come across as a kind of genial elder statesman of the entertainment business, you know, and
That's nice.
I think I can't remember whether it's today's episode or yesterday's episode. I do actually win a wheelie case with Richard Osman's face on it, which I haven't used in public yet, but I will do.
Nice guy, Richard.
Yeah, he seemed very nice, very good at doing that job.
Yeah.
And of course, he also devised it as well. So, you know, it's the number one show on BBC Two. Which, I mean, it's not, viewership isn't massive these days, but I mean, it's still, that's quite to devise something. He's very clever. I mean, he's one of that Cambridge lot, but I mean,
yeah.
You know, he's way
up.
He
comes across as very professional and kind of straightforward, although he has a cheeky side to him, but he does come across as very professional.
Yeah, he seemed very nice.
I've not seen your episodes yet, but that show, there's no reason to be hateful or angry on that show. It's a very pleasant seeming experience, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not like some Battle of Wills, like... Mock the Week or something, you know. I mean, it's just a nice, genial.
Did you get some laughs?
There's not an audience there, so it's done without an
audience.
But
was there room to, like, be silly and have a joke?
I'm witty. I'm extremely witty.
Were you trying to win?
Oscar Wilde of anti-Zionist politics.
Yes. Did you find yourself trying to win? Were you competitive?
Yeah. Yeah, the first episode. The first episode, I think I did right, but it took me a while to kind of get the reins. But Emma won two episodes, and Anthony Costa is very good at quizzes. Won two rounds, and I won one round. I won, you know, one.
You won one. Oh, that's great.
I won on one day. Yeah. I mean, Kelly's lovely, really, but she said herself she's dyslexic and. Yeah, so she didn't really.
Well, yeah, not all of our brains are wired to be in that kind of.
She seemed an absolute delight. No, it was very sweet because her and Anthony Costa are both. She was in Eternal, I think, girl band, and he was in Blue, the boy band.
Right.
I think they both came from like Tottenham or somewhere, and they, you know, it was very sweet. The kind of interaction between them, because they'd obviously been through a lot of stuff, you know.
Similar experience.
Yeah, in that period, yeah. And, you know, knowing each other. And it was just nice to, I didn't know who they were talking about, but, you know, it was just nice to, just kind of just watch their banter and stuff. It was very, it was charming. And Emma, I think, is very funny. Comic actor.
Well, I'm very happy to hear that you've had an uplifting.
Yeah, just
positive...
as well. I didn't have a fucking gigantic publicity campaign centered on the transmission of that, though, since it went out a week early or two weeks early. I didn't really.
Yeah.
And there's also my upcoming Celebrity Antiques Roadshow.
No. What are you talking about?
Oh, I told you about that.
No, you don't tell me anything, Alexi. What?
Me and Nigel Planer are on Celebrity Antiques Road Trip.
Are you the antiques?
No, we're not. Cons.
Oh, sorry. That was rude of me. Please forgive me. What's your role in that? What are you doing?
What happens is the two celebrities, they drive around in an antique car, or usually two antique cars. One of them broke down, so we had to share a car. And then you buy antiques. You're given a budget of £400. You buy antiques and at various antique shops, warehouses and shit like that. And then your antiques are auctioned, and the one who makes a profit, the profit goes to charity.
Wow.
It's a competition because who can make the most money or who can lose
between you
money.
And Nigel, or are you
between
a team?
Between me and Nigel.
Oh, yeah. Wow. That sounds like a laugh. Was it fun?
Yeah, it was great. I mean, we spent, I think, two days up the northeast and then another day in Bristol. And we know we spend a lot of time. I mean, we are genuine friends. I mean, I saw him last night. I mean, we are genuine.
So the rapport must have been great.
Yes.
Oh, that's so cool. I can't wait to watch that.
Aging thespians in an antique car buying shit.
What was the car?
There's an MGC, which is an MG with the straight six-cylinder, 3-litre.
Was that a joy?
Engine. No, it was a nightmare, really. And I kept mistaking. I assumed they won't put any of it in, but I kept mistaking the clutch for the brake, so I was stamping on the brake clutch, trying to stop, just going into the back of the camera car, shouting, total brake failure, total brake failure. And Nigel was just sitting there looking. I think he's, I don't know what is the expression on his face, but it's just because I'm trying to stop the car by using the clutch.
I can't imagine they'll really cut work. That out. Come on.
Total brake failure, yeah. I know it's just a Celebrity Antiques Road Trip also has a rather sarcastic voiceover, so which I didn't know when we made it. Not that it matters, but yeah, no, I was trying to do stuff that it's a bit more genial, really, just so sort of make the public like me for when I get locked up for supporting terrorism by Starmer's Gestapo police.
Police.
Yeah. So I thought I'll do. There's a few other things I may be doing. I was supposed to do the last series of Would I Lie to You, but I couldn't do it in the end. But hopefully I would maybe do the next series. Mm. And stuff like that. You know, I just actually thought, why am I saying no to all this stuff? You know, real reason.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there is.
There's no real reason. You say it yourself, you have many facets. Yeah. And so why not say yes to stuff, you know? And that includes, you know, delivering speeches at the Palestine marches.
Yeah.
And includes going to meetings and guesting at lectures and things about Palestine and medical aid for Palestinians.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And to have someone who's doing all that stuff and yet still being invited to participate in these
genial kind of news. Yeah, it's true. Yeah,
it's you're an anomaly.
Bizarre. Yeah, it's
a lot of people are getting blacklisted for even mentioning Palestine, aren't they?
Yeah,
you're untouchable. Yeah,
I am a weird, as you say, weird kind of show business anomaly, really. But I mean, yeah, no, I think it actually does. I wouldn't do stuff like Strictly, because I think it's kind of grotesque, really, and what they...
I used to work on Strictly, and I can say, right. Avoid it.
Yeah.
It is a horrible environment. And now it's all coming out, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I worked on it fucking 12 or so years ago, and it was horrible then as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't do Strictly. I wouldn't do I'm a Celebrity. I wouldn't do any of those where they humiliate you.
What about Celebrity Big Brother?
No, none of that. I wouldn't do any of that. Anything where you can keep your dignity, I think, is why not, really?
There's a contestant on Big Brother who was wearing a Palestine T-shirt, a watermelon.
Oh, right.
T-shirt.
No, I've got one of them, yeah.
And they blacked it out.
Really?
They CGI'd the watermelon out of her T-shirt.
That's where we're at.
On the repeats of it, someone got hired to just black out her T-shirt.
Yeah.
Not even like with pixelated censorship. It's like they made it look like it was just a black T-shirt. And she was wearing like a hoodie over it. So it took work. That must take work to.
Yeah, well, that's part of the enveloping darkness. I thought let's try and maintain the bright and breezy.
Oh, God, how long is that going to last? But no, we can keep it bright and breezy.
That we had before October the 7th.
Well, we are allowed to be happy and bright and breezy and then switch from that to talking about real issues.
Yeah, I woke up this morning feeling quite jolly and I thought, well, I don't know what's that, you know, that's such a rarity. I thought try and keep it going as long as possible. Which is not to say that today isn't as bleak as yesterday and the day before and every day for the last
year. We live in a fucking time where you feel guilty for being happy.
Yes, I think you do, yeah. But then you also, in the end, you think, well, how's this helping anybody, really?
Exactly.
Yeah. But, you feel what you feel, really. Yeah, so I was very, the poem that I read, that Linda Duggar, I couldn't. I sometimes go into those speeches at Trafalgar Square without really thinking what I'm going to say, and it, you know,
well, let's give some context. People. Hold on, some people might not know what you're talking about.
Sorry, I spoke. I read a poem at the Palestine rally in Trafalgar Square last Saturday, and it was a very powerful poem by James Baldwin. But it was good to have it rather than just me going up there and saying weird shit. It was just, I talked a bit about the power of poetry, and then I read this poem, which is...
I've got a clip.
Oh, go on then.
Right.
I'm going to read a poem by James Baldwin. He wrote it at the time of the Vietnam War. Sadly, James Baldwin's poem is as relevant now as it was when it was written. It is called Every Bombed Village Is My Hometown. And every dead child is my child. And every grieving mother is my mother. Every crying father is my father. Every home turned to rubble is the home that I grew up in. Every brother carrying the remains of his brother across borders is my brother. Every sister waiting for a sister who will never come home is my sister. Every one of these people are ours, just like we are theirs. We belong to them and they belong to us.
There's such weird events, those things, it's hard to get the tone right, but I just sort of thought halfway through, I think I'll kind of ramp this up. So
good choice to have come in with a poem that resonates, and rather than being rambling sort of, and just you're right,
also no criticism to anybody really, but what is there left to say in a sense about them to restate the horrors, which I suppose has its place really, but my background, my training, as it were, would always be to try and find something
performance.
My inclination would be but to find something
and
different.
You really crank it up, don't you? Halfway through, you were telling me.
I do. I suddenly thought, I might as well give this, And I think it works, in that context.
You make a good point. What is there left to say? Like, we've done a big march. We arrived to this focal point.
15 big,
There's a big stage and the crowd all gathers. And everyone there is for the same reason. So, you're very likely to end up saying things that everyone there already agrees with and knows. So the two actual real benefits of those speeches at the end of March is, thinking about it now, is one would be to make it instructional, tell us what we can do to spread the cause and help the people we're trying to help. And the second, which is really vital, is to just enforce that sense of solidarity and togetherness and to make us feel empowered so that when we spread out and go into the world, we know we're not alone and that we are in our thousands and hundreds of thousands.
It just cheers people, it just reinvigorates people who are there. It just makes them feel better, really. But I think there's a broader point really about, which I address in my book, which should be coming out next year at some point. But that, people, there's a kind of assumption both in the demonstrations of the Arab Spring and in, movements like Occupy and Just Stop All, that somehow the answer is contained within the demonstration, that somehow by demonstrating, by occupying, centers of capitalism, somehow an answer will emerge, and it won't really. I mean, the clear lesson I think from all that stuff and from the Palestinian demonstrations is that a political organization needs to come out of this, really, and to a degree is, I think. There are five independent pro, Gaza MPs in Parliament, which is unheard of. I mean, not that you'll hear the mainstream media, but we, pro-Gaza, we have more fucking MPs than the Reform Party, but you'll never hear that discussed on the mainstream media, which is truly exists as kind of propaganda for
and probably all
capitalism.
All the sleeper pro-Palestinian politicians who are not even vocal about it, but there must be in amongst the Labour throng.
Well, I mean, Leah Mohammed came very close. Craig Murray came very close. You know, you could have had, you nearly had, you could have had 10, it was only the shenanigans partly of the Labour Party putting up fake Gaza candidates, you know. I mean, they're clever fuckers. So I think that went on, you know, to take votes away from genuine pro-Gaza candidates. And, you know, I think the Greens should have stood down. I think it was Leah Mohammed, wasn't it, who was standing against West Streeting, that if the Greens had stood down, then only lost by 500 votes. He would have been beaten, and that would have been amazing.
That would have been huge.
I think the Greens are a bit to blame for that, right? So there is a political movement emerging now. Obviously, Andrew Feinstein is organising here in against Starmer and against the right wing of Labour and Camden Council, and you know, I hope, you know, that it's slow work. I mean,
it's very Weber, slow. I can't remember which previous guest it was who was. What's it, Mr. Griffiths, Dr. Griffiths or whatever, Professor.
Yeah,
he was talking about how we should focus our energy on one candidate at a time, one constituency at a time, rather than having 100,000 volunteers spread across dozens of constituencies.
You've seen,
But I think how many years that would take to one by one win candidates all over the country.
Well, I think it can happen in, I don't know if he was saying that really. I mean, it can happen in multiple constituencies if the activists are there on the ground. But it definitely needs to happen. It needs to be, also needs to be come from the ground up. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you've seen the failure over the years of all these kind of, you know, Socialist Alliance, Left Unity. I mean, that doesn't work for a left party to just put up a candidate and hope that they will somehow magically get elected. I mean, it needs, you know, Weber, the great theoretician of social democracy, really described, you know, the business of politics as the slow boring through hard wood. You know, it's just the line I first heard in the West Wing, I remember. But it's, you know, it's this idea that you drill in very slowly through teak. You know, but that, I mean, that is what the business of politics, if you're in the politics of change, then I guess that's what it is. It is the slow boring through hardwood. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, there is, and I guess there is no other way around. There's no, if you're in the politics of colonialism and shoring up capitalism, then you're going to proceed very, very, very rapidly. But, you know, building an alternative takes time, and it also takes the right tactics. Really, I think Andrew is very admirable in what he's doing here, and you know, the others. I think Jamie Driscoll in the Northeast is organised, and they're talking to each other. You know,
my father always used the analogy, similar analogy of politics being a huge ship that people are fighting to steer in different directions,
right,
and it's only changing direction by inches, inch by inch, and you just have to keep trying to get it to turn your direction until it's...
Yeah, I mean, particularly when you're trying to do something, as you know, something against the you know, the current as we're trying to
do. I think we can agree that in the case of Israel and wider imperialist and colonial domination, I think something more rapid is needed, something...
Well, you can't, what's that line about, you know, the way kind of catastrophes that you could perhaps be ready for that, you know, that, you know, catastrophes happen very slowly and then very, very quickly.
Mm.
And I guess you could, you know, I mean, I don't know if we are going to see that, but I mean, you could see the collapse of the US empire, for instance, that all this is part of that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then suddenly the collapse could happen very, very quickly. What replaces and what, you know, but I mean, I think there doesn't really seem any quick way to found a kind of political movement that, you know, takes on the might of, you know, the neoliberalism, really, which is what all this shit is. So, but, you know, it's at least something, you know, on my good days, I think at least that is happening, you know. We'll see. But it's...
Something's happening out there.
Yeah.
What it is, I mean, it's exactly clear.
No. But it you know, that it, to see the monster so, I mean, quote Gramsci, we are living in a time of monsters. To see that it takes the horrific deaths of so many people to reveal the monster and its true grotesqueness is heartbreaking, really. But at least we are seeing it now. We're seeing it.
Absolutely.
It's pulled its mask off, yeah. You know. At least to us, at least to those who, you know, have eyes to see. So, yeah, and there
yeah,
we are.
Yeah.
Do you have some questions for me from the... Have we got anything?
I do.
Museum of Comedy, if that hasn't... Museum of Comedy and Work in Progress shows. We plugged it last time. We should plug it again.
Want me to get the dates up?
Yeah. Work in Progress, a new series, Sandwich Bar. It's kind of written. It's going very well. The BBC have been very... Talked to Rich at BBC Studios. He's very happy with what there is so far. It's great. It's really good, I think. But, you know, just help me make it better by sitting with me as I you know, do Work in Progress on shows 1 and 2, and then on another night it'll be shows 3 and 4. And it'll be like an actual recording. So much, but it's really difficult to get into those recordings. We turn away hundreds of people, which is a sad thing to do. But if you come to the Museum of Comedy, it'll be like effectively you are at one of those recordings.
Basically, yeah, and 2 episodes a night.
So that'll be an hour. And I'll also, you know, I'll do stuff. Or the stuff that's unbroadcastable.
So I guess you're going to do a full series on 16th and 17th of November, 2 different shows.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, only the 17th has tickets available.
Okay.
Sunday the 17th. Yeah, 16th right. is sold out. There is a waiting list, good. Though, so do head to museumofcomedy.com.
Yeah.
Get on the waiting list if that's the only date you can make. Then you're going to do another full series on... 29th and 30th of November.
Yeah.
Both sold out. Waiting lists available.
Oh, okay.
And then you've got one more show on the 1st of December. So what, are you going to do the episodes that you think need the most work?
I don't know. I'll see how I feel, really. Yeah, probably. Okay. Yeah.
There are tickets left for the 1st of December. Sunday, 1st of December. Right. Museum of Comedy in the Bloomsbury.
All right, yeah, because, well, if they're going that quick, you better get in there, because it's obviously going to go pretty rapid. I mean, usually things don't, you know, sell out. People book very late now, so the fact that most of those, 3 of those 5 shows are sold out is, I'm presuming the other 2 are pretty much nearly.
You would imagine so, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, get on it, mate. Oh, and there's a ticket available where you get... for a little bit more, for like a fiver more, you get a glass of mulled wine and a mince pie with your entry.
That's something to do with me, but you know, I heartily approve that message. I've also got 2 Palestine. I think one sold out, nearly sold out. Alexi Sale and Friends or something at Amnesty International in Shoreditch. Benefit with various top comedians, and on the 24th of November. And then there's also a Stop the War benefit I'm doing that I'm sort of emceeing.
Let me correct that for you. It's Thursday, the 14th of November.
14th of November.
Alexis Sell and Friends. Tickets are selling fast. Stand Up for Gaza.
That's nearly gone, I know, yeah.
Amnesty International is the location in Shoreditch.
Yeah.
So just search for Alexis Sale and Friends. It's the first thing that comes up.
I better start thinking about saying that one, yeah.
So you're hosting that incredible lineup. Yes. And then, yes, November the 6th at the Phoenix Arts Club. What's happening?
No, that's a comic strip thing.
What's that?
That's one of those. That's like mining my very distance. It's like that is Peter Richardson. It's like a bit like what we did at Glastonbury, but for the comic strip rather than the young ones.
Oh,
very similar. So there's two comic strip films will be shown. Then there'll be a Q&A. It's only around the corner from my house, so I said I've done a couple of them.
Yep.
And I don't mind. Again, I suppose it's a bit like, I mean, you shouldn't get stuck mining your past, but I don't mind doing. Lisa's trying to put together a kind of a similar Young Ones tour, you know, where you watch clips of the Young Ones and then do Q&A. And Peter is also doing, so there's a rival kind of comic strip tour as well. I think there was one when somebody was telling me last night Maxine Peake had turned up. We do, you know, you just you show some films and then you just, you know, some of the cast, it's usually me and Nigel, I think, turn up and answer questions. And it's fine, you know, I don't mind doing that shit as well, you know, as long as it's not all I do, you know, that I'm not just somebody who lives in the past, really.
Well, like Sir Lenny was Henry. Like Sir Lenny was saying, you got to just own up to your history and the things you've done. Exactly. And just appreciate
that. With that.
People
yeah.
are still very fond of that stuff, even though it seems like ancient news.
Yeah.
But that's the Comic Strip Presents at the Phoenix Arts Club in Soho, 6th of November. Someone called Basim reached out on Instagram to say they'll see you there, Alexi.
Okay, and
they'll be screening GLC, The Carnage Continues, Red Nose of Courage
is an odd one. I'm less in love with it than Peter is. So Peter loves, it was a film, it's a 1 hour film where Adrian plays John Major and I play his dad.
Oh.
And, you know, John Major's dad was actually in the circus.
Oh.
So it's this idea that John Major was this is for people. Stop the World Benefit is the 27th of November, by the way. I just looked
it up. Okay.
I don't know where it is, always on. But so John Major plays is a clown in the circus that's run by his dad. But he's also the leader of the Conservatives. He's also Prime Minister during the day and then a circus clown at night. I mean, it's where it's sort of those themes that Peter started with. I mean, this is entirely for those people who are interested in the kind of micro history of TV comedy, I suppose. But you know, it's that theme that Peter started with, the strike, where, you know, Hollywood filmmakers are making a movie starring Al Pacino playing Arthur Scargill, and, you know, strike about, you know, which won all the awards that year, in which I play the. I play the writer of the script. In this one, this is just sort of similar in a way that John Major's in the circus and his dad, he's a clown, but he's split really. His affections are split really. And Dawn plays the leader of the Labour Party as a Welsh woman, and she falls in love with Coco the clown. But hates John Major, the MP. I play a lot of it with my shirt off. I was quite not bad physique in those days. It was only shown once, I think, on television on election night in, I don't know, was it what year, whether it was 97, the year that Blair won, or whether it was the 92 when Major won. I don't know when it was shown. Anyway. It's a kind of weird. Peter loves it. I mean, I don't know. I'm sort of more critical of my own performance.
Well, even as an oddity, it might be worth the watch still. Anyway,
it's certainly worth
an original.
It's an interesting piece of work, really, and it is. Peter, I was talking to Peter on the phone. I mean, he sort of compares it to like, what's it? You know, the Cyrano de Bergerac, in a sense, where. It doesn't quite compare, but I mean, so it's an interesting film anyway. That will be screened, and I think he's doing other screenings of that.
And the GLC,
I don't know if I'm in the GLC one.
Are you in the third one, which is Gregory Diary of a Nutcase?
No, I'm not in that.
So you're just in the one of them.
I think so, yeah. Okay. I don't think I was in GLC for God knows what.
I found the info for the Stop the War Coalition Christmas fundraiser, yeah. November 27th, 7 p.m. It's in the Seven Dials Club in the oh. West End. Yeah, you're going to be there. Corbyn's going to be there. Oh, my friend Esther Manito, she's really funny.
Lebanese, she was on.
Khalid Abdullah, and a bunch more. And there'll be a raffle. Yeah, there'll be a raffle, kids, as well.
That's
at stopthewar.org.uk. You can find tickets for
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I mean, Stop the War are, you know, highly, highly admirable organisation. So, yeah, I'm going to be there as well. So, see me live there, kids. But yeah,
I've got some listener questions.
Yeah.
Do you want to hear some?
Yeah. This is good. Yeah.
Yeah. So yesterday I put a call out on Instagram. Follow us on Instagram at AlexisAlePod. I did a call out for questions. I said, we're recording tomorrow. Give me any questions you have. We've already addressed the first two about House of Games and Phoenix Arts Club. All right. I'll just go through these. M asks, don't want to raise your blood pressure, but I'd love opinions on Labour and government, though they've just done their first 100 days, I think, last week or something.
I told you, didn't I? I warned everybody. Who was out there first? I mean, when was last series of Sandwich Hour with the
matches?
Tom Wyman wrote I Hate Keir Starmer. I mean, it was...
Who wrote
2021?
It?
2021. A guy called Tom Wyman. I adapted it, but he very much wrote it, really. An academic up in Leeds.
You were on the Fuck Keir Starmer train a long time ago.
Yeah. I'd seen the bastard and knew what he was like. I didn't know he was going to be this bad, to be honest.
Is there anything else that stood out to you apart from... the, you know, obviously the gaping hole of compassion for Palestinians, but anything, how they've been around domestic issues, anything?
They seem more, I don't know. I mean, it's a lot. They seem much more incompetent than I thought they were going to be. I thought, you know, their only offer would be that they would govern with a bit more efficiency than the Conservatives, who are obviously we're utterly inefficient, but really they seem as bad. And I think I've seen somewhere, I mean, commentary that said that really all that unites them was hatred of Corbyn, really, and support for Israel, I suppose. And apart from that they hate each other, and you can see that they are wildly factional, that there's obviously tensions between Angela Rayner's camp, Ange, and you know, the Red Starmer and the shitbags around him. But there's obviously the stuff with Sue Gray, and I think they all absolutely hate each other because they're hateful people. They're people who are full of... the Luke A. Kirsts. They're full of corruption.
Selfish.
But,
you know, they're selfish utterly more than hateful, I think. Even.
Utterly bought and paid for. And so they're sort of, they're fighting each other as well as. Mm. So I see whether they'll be able to present the illusion of competence as they go on. But certainly for now, I mean, and Starmer, I mean, I always knew he's a little shit, but I mean, his little shittiness is clear to the British people, you know, which is not always the case. Really, that Blair was a bastard, but he was popular. But the people can, I mean, it's Starmer is so, at the moment, so hated. If you know, his popularity is lower than, is the lowest anybody's ever been, really. So people really, really. He's a hateful person, and you know that his hateful energy, I think, spreads outward to, you know, his cabinet and his government, and in a sense to the government's, this country's behaviour.
Well,
really,
I think he's changed. He actually has completely changed, and he's very full of compassion now and love for the Palestinians, especially. Because someone on Twitter has flagged this, his post from yesterday to us. He writes,
today, Angela Rayner and I met members of the Palestinian community in the UK who have lost loved ones in Gaza, alongside Dr. Hossam Zumlot, head of the Palestinian mission. I am humbled by their immeasurable grief. This horrific suffering must end. There must be an immediate ceasefire, and Israel must let unrestricted aid into Gaza now. Yeah. There's a picture of him with all of those.
Shit. Does he say he's going to do anything to bring that about? Or just make,
that's a good point.
You know, just to say words is nothing. Do something.
Yeah, the first comment is, have you tried not selling weapons to the people who are killing their relatives?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, a lot of hate in the responses to him.
Is that on our thing or just on...
No, this is just on Twitter.
On Twitter, yeah. No, I think it's empty-hand-wringing, isn't it? You know, it's... He's completely in the pocket of the Israel lobby. Taking vast amounts of money from them.
Exactly. I had a thought... I don't know if I mentioned this on the show, about how, especially in America, I should say, that it's, I think the biggest case of money laundering that's ever occurred, because they're donating billions and billions of taxpayers' money to Israel, who are then using that same money to buy weapons off of America.
Yes.
So there, it's just a...
It's a scam. It's a scam.
It's a legal way for them to steal tax money, isn't it? And put it right back in their pockets.
Give it to the arms manufacturers. Absolutely. Yes, I think that is absolutely true. And same here. You know, I mean, America, you know, America's infrastructure is... a long time since I've been to the States, but apparently the infrastructure is crumbling. Schools are... Mm-hmm. You know, uninhabitable. The medical system is obviously a disgrace unless you're wealthy. Mm-hmm. And yet billions and billions of dollars are being funneled to Israel. Yeah, and then a lot of that money obviously goes to Israel. Yeah, it's, some of it's siphoned off by Netanyahu's wife to buy handbags. And then the rest of it goes back to American arms manufacturers who, you know, and
it's so obvious. It's money laundering.
Yeah, we should get Andrew Feinstein on to talk about the arms trade, really.
Please.
I mean, just the arms trade is, you know, it's the most malevolent force in the world, really, because it is just money that the best that you can hope for if you buy a tank is that it never kills anybody. It never generates. You know, if you buy a tractor, it will, you know, it will till the ground and grow food. The best the tank will do is just sit there. The worst it'll do is kill hundreds of people, you know. And so the arms is, it's a malevolent. It's also, you know, because I'm interested in weaponry and very rare as a lefty. But just the scandals that, you know, with British Aerospace is really our only arms manufacturer, and they charge what they like. But there's the new British armored fighting vehicle, the Ajax, which I think has cost $7 billion to develop, and it makes the troops in it throw up. I mean, it can't, it's unusable. The Type 46 destroyers that we built stop, and if the weather gets hot, they stop, and it doesn't mean just the engines stop, but all the weapon systems die, and so it's just this vulnerable target floating helpless. It's a famous case, of course, the British Army assault rifle, the SA-80, where if you were left-handed, it just ejected hot, red-hot casings into your ear. And also, if you brushed the magazine catch, it fell out, so troops were going into battle in the first Iraq war, and then suddenly looked down and found that there was no rounds in the weapon because the magazine had dropped out.
Proving that guns don't kill people, bullets do. Proving that old
saying. In this case, at least, I suppose you could say the SA-80 or the L-85 later became as a weapon of peace because it didn't work. and then had to be rebuilt by Heckler and Koch. Those. It's like a couple having an affair. Those two aircraft carriers, which again cost $7 billion, the Queen Elizabeth and the Prince of Wales, are never seen out together in public because one of them is always broken. And in port being repaired, they've never been able to actually put to sea together because they're so badly made that they shit doesn't work. Oh, you know, I mean, that's the tip of the iceberg with British arms procurement. The United States, the same, it's just that they throw even more money.
Hence why Israel only buy, like, basically computer parts for their missiles and stuff from the UK, right?
I don't know. I mean, some of the shit, I mean, you know, it's not... I don't know. Some of the shit works. A lot of it doesn't. I mean, I'm just saying it's a tremendous... It's not only evil in its intent, but it's a tremendous waste of money.
Waste of money, yes.
Even in its own terms, you know, the shit that Britain buys and makes doesn't even work, even in its own terms of killing innocent people. At least that's maybe we should be grateful for that, but it's just... It's a massive...
There's this video going around at the moment of this fella walking around an arms fair. I think it's in America. And he's going around to the Elbit Systems section and all these other sections. And he's going up to people. Excuse me, sir. Yes, I was just wondering, where do I buy the baby shredding equipment? Where do I buy the... the bombs that shred babies. Where do I buy that, sir? Thank you. And all these people, they start off, they turn to him and smile. Oh, yeah, how can I help you? And then he says baby shredding, and you see their kind of frozen smiles, and they just look so awkward because he's just saying it plainly. The only things you're selling here are instruments of death, and babies are the most vulnerable.
I don't know who you would be to go into that business and to think to be in an office where... You know, you are all working together on how best to, you know, which is that they do have a bomb, don't they? The treads people. I mean,
babies. How are you this morning, Joan? Oh, I'm great, thank you. Cup of tea?
Yeah, great.
Absolutely. Oh, how are the kids? Oh, fantastic. No, not those kids, the brown kids. Oh, yeah, shredded to bits, actually. Yeah. Oh, great, fantastic.
I think people lie to themselves. I don't know how you...
They've worked their way up.
I don't know how you
They've been poached, like, as business people. They've been, like, poached or something. Or is it just in the family? Oh, my dad worked for this company and his dad. So they know no better.
Yeah.
All right, not much time left, so let's fly through some questions.
Okay,
someone's interested. David is interested in an episode, doing a whole episode one day about your fiction books that you wrote in the 2000s. Weeping Women, Mr. Roberts, etc.
Yeah.
I read Overtaken recently. I was very pleasantly surprised. It's a fucking fantastic book.
It is the best of my novels, probably the first one. But it is. I'm very proud of that, really. Yes, it was a funny, it was like a strange interlude now when I was a writer. But yeah, I know there are.
How well do you remember the content of those books?
Well, Overtaken. I mean, Overtaken should be it's a really interesting central idea there. It's really, you know, somebody should make a movie out of it.
They should. It would make a really good movie.
So, yeah, Mr. Roberts, I can remember very well. The Weeping Women, I'd say. A lot of the short stories were done on Radio 4. And are available on Audible, I see.
But to do a whole podcast about those books, what would we do?
Well, you could talk about them, I suppose. You could talk about my years as an author, really. It was
the process and what your life looked like at the time. Or do you want to just talk about that now, or shall we save it for our next?
And let's do it another
next time. We are one on one. Yeah, I'll try to remember to ask you. Okay, someone asks, what was the train encounter with Badil really like?
Well, that was exactly as it seemed, really. I mean, it was we were doing Hereford to London, we were doing London Bound to Hereford, and my producer said, I can't remember, but we bumped into him because he was going to Hay, really. I mean, I'm I know, David is part of the kind of extended group of people that I know, really. You know, he's part of, I mean, less so. I know a lot less in that group than I used to, but we used to have lunch together. I was fond of him, really, and I just thought it would be, he said, well, I'll do an interview if you want. I said, yeah. I mean, we didn't. I mean, my inclination on that show anyway, it's not an interrogation. It's just, you know, let people talk about what they want, really. So we didn't get into it. Was, as you heard, really, it was a perfectly pleasant interchange in which we didn't mention, I didn't mention the terrible things that he is.
Well, yes. So
you could say he's done, really. So, I was so fond of him as a person, really. He's very engaging, really, David. But it's a sort of weird, we talked about, you know, my inside outside kind of status, really, that I'm not, you know, you take some fire brother. There's a guy called Tony Greensteinstein. You know, for instance, you know, pro Jewish, trained as a rabbi, but fiercely pro Palestinian, you know, and he's very much, I don't know, I thought, because I was just reading. He's outside. He's not. There's no conceivable way in which somebody like him is inside. But I have this weird kind of position where I'm both inside and outside, you know, in that I will not dilute my support for Palestine. But I'm also, you know, I'm trying to think.
You're genial. You know, you're friendly.
I'm friendly, and I also, you know, I have a certain status as an entertainer, you know, amongst people who, what I do now and what I did then. So if I'm, you know, if I'm in a restaurant and the director general of the BBC came past, he would stop and say hello, really. And so that there's that contradiction there with the, you know, David's kind of, you know, kind of in the sense of somebody that I've known. And so there's, you know, I don't know whether that makes me better or worse, whether I should be let the viewers think, you know, what they tell me, but, you know, whether I should
when
be
that picture was
more aggressive with him.
Yeah, exactly. When that picture was circulating of you and him on the train, it was a small minority, but they always make the loudest noise. But some people are like, why didn't you kick his teeth in? Like, why weren't you having a fight? Yeah. Why didn't you?
Well, you know, maybe I should have done. But I mean, I also think I didn't object to, like, him putting up that picture as well, because I think people need to deal with the contradictions that I am somebody, you know, I am who I am, and yet that is me as well, really. And you have to decide what you think about that, you know,
let's also be fucking frank here. You were working.
Yeah,
you were there working.
Yeah, that's true. Yes, you're right. Yeah.
You're not going to do that. You're not at the pub having a pint.
No, it's true.
And both you and Bidil, sorry to cut you off, but your differences are very, you're very aware of your differences to each other and your differences of opinion. And so is everyone. But you're also a nice guy, Alexei. And especially if you're with people who are looking up to you and you're working with them, you had Runo there with you and a producer and all that, you're going to start kicking off on the train while recording your very pleasant show, Strangers on a Train. If you're in the middle of a taping of Sandwich Bar and he heckled you or something,
he would get the full force.
You know, it's context. So people are trying to give Alexei a hard time about that photograph of an experienced, very aware person being a gentleman in a very specific context. You know, fucking...
Well, thank you for... Yeah.
Get a life, you know. Fuck's
yeah,
sake.
Yeah. Well, thank you for putting it like that, yeah.
Okay, Kate asks, who was Wilf's favourite guest?
Wilf.
Any of you got any thoughts on skinhead culture, Alexei? We had two questions about skinheads, which is weird. Someone's asking about sharp skinheads in particular, SHARP.
I wasn't I don't know. It was always, I mean, it was one of the things that I always sort of struggled with a bit, really, is that kind of contradictory thing, because I sort of dressed, you know, my stage character dressed as a skinhead, but I was never part of that. I was never,
right.
It was an act, really. And so in that sense, I was inauthentic, and it sometimes kind of bothered me that I wasn't, you know, I wasn't what I was
portraying yourself
to a degree as, presenting yeah. on stage, really. I think there was a contradiction there, really, which I never entirely resolved in my own. But I was not, I'm not that.
No.
I was never that guy. I was never a skinhead at school than that. I mean, I was kind of a hippie, really, if anything.
But at the same time, you weren't one of the fascist twats who has bastardized the skinhead kind of culture.
No, obviously not. I mean, I did occasionally get, I mean, I remember doing a gig in Southend, and I think there was these like four skinheads, right-wing skinheads, in the audience. And I was they were making a noise. And I said, what are you doing here? And they said, oh, I can't get a skinhead. You know? I said, mate, I'm a communist Jew. You've really come to the wrong... you've come to the wrong show here. But they, I shut them up partly through, the violence of my performance. And I think they came backstage and they were charming.
just a couple more quick ones. Salam asks, would be great if you did an episode on Arabs in Western cinema? Love you guys, he says.
That's
we kind
certainly.
Of touched on the topic with Ellen E. Jones. We touched on it with the Ahmed Jalili episode as well. But I think this is a subject close to my heart. I've written essays on this shit.
You could, you've what essays read?
Written essays at uni about this stuff and an age ago. But I love the topic of representation in cinema. I think it's really powerful. More than we think, because it kind of sets subconsciously our whole opinion of an entire race of people can be set by how they're represented on screen.
Yeah.
As Ellen says in her book, how powerful it is in cinema and TV.
Yeah.
There is a recommend there's an essay that was then turned into a documentary film called Real Bad Arabs. And real is spelt with two E's, like a film reel. It's a really interesting film that just talks about how Arabs have been represented in cinema and vilified. But we were kind of chatting about this, Alexia and myself, on the phone the other day about maybe doing some sort of film club kind of thing where we'd set some homework.
Yeah.
Have you had a think about a film you'd want to watch that we could all do as a community?
Well, the film that I thought of was Edge of Tomorrow.
I love that film.
Tom Cruise.
I love that film.
Emily Blunt at the height of her Emily Bluntness.
Yeah. Live, Die, Repeat, it's known as in America, I think.
Weird. Edge of Tomorrow. Really. It's also directed by Doug, to keep our Bourne kind of theme going. Directed by Doug Liman, who, of course, was responsible for the first Bourne film. Set the template, really. It was Paul Greengrass took over.
So I thought maybe as a fun new feature of the show, we could set some homework for the listeners. So as a community, we can all consume a piece of media. In this case, it would be Edge of Tomorrow. Find it however you want to find it and watch it.
It's on Amazon.
And then on the next episode, probably in the outro, me and Alexi will have a discussion about the film.
Yeah, well, I'd be interested to hear people's views on it.
Really, and if you at home watch the film and want to share your views, you can message us on Instagram at AlexisLPod. You can email AlexisLPodcast@gmail.com. Or you can head over to patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast. That's patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast. You can contribute to the show there. You can donate some money towards the show, towards my wages. And you can message me on there. And I've also set up a really cool community chat, which has been popping off. There is the TASP chat, the AlexisL podcast chat on the Patreon. So everyone who contributes to the Patreon is welcome to kind of chat on there and say hello to each other, share your opinions on latest episodes and your opinion on Edge of Tomorrow.
someone posted on there, they were in Buxton train station. And in the chat, they shared a picture of this plaque with your mug on it, Alexi. And it says this plaque, and there's a statue next to the plaque of some fucking bullshit man.
Well, go on, read out the plaque.
Okay, the statue's like made out of bits and bits. I guess it's reclaimed art, and it looks, it's meant to be a train guard. And the plaque says, "This is Joe. This plaque commemorates the naming of the guard statue by Alexi Sale, comedian, actor, broadcaster, recording artist, and writer. He was named in honor of Alexi's dad, Joseph Henry, a lifelong guard. Joe was made from metal salvaged from Buxton Traction Maintenance Depot.
That's right, my dad,
before it was demolished in 2016. The depot, which opened in 1957, blah, 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 blah. Oh, they've quoted you here. Okay. The artist, Andy Hill, wanted to ensure that the sheds didn't simply disappear. So he's kept them alive in this statue. But where's your quote? Oh, Alexi Sale added, "I'm very I can't do an impression of you. I can't do the accent. I'm very pleased." That's nothing like you. I'll just read it like me. Alexi Sale added, "I'm very pleased and touched to see this memorial named Joe in honor of my dad and all railway guards." That's very sweet. I did not know your dad was a railway guard.
Yeah, well, his life, more or less, yeah. That's why we got free travel all over Europe.
Oh!
That's why a lot of my stuff is about train, you know, like Strangers on a Train, in a sense, is about...
Oh, my God!
It's about the railways, because I have that lifelong connection.
Of course, you've created so much shit about trains.
It's in our blood. It says in the opening of my second volume of memoirs. That's just all my trousers. You know, there's two things in our family: was railways and Marxism. Really, so we thought there was no situation in the world that couldn't be cured either by a violent overthrow of capitalism or by getting on a train. I mean, that was a weird. I mean, it's also the kind of the debris that you leave around as a minor celebrity, isn't it? That I was actually up in Buxton doing a book reading at the Opera House, I think, which is an amazing structure there. Buxton is actually a very pretty town as well. And so they said, "Well, as you're passing through, you know, can you come and attend the unveiling of this statue?" It's not, I would say it's not to everybody's taste. The statue of my dad, something heroic in the kind of Lenin socialist realist tradition might have been better, but it is what it is. Yeah.
It's funky looking. I have to confess, I haven't read your bloody memoirs, so that's why I didn't know that, probably.
Yeah. Compulsory.
Yeah, but I probably should get around to it at some point. I'd probably have so many...
They're an entertaining read.
I've heard. But, you know, when you know someone personally, it's not... You don't tend to consume their stuff as much. I'm in my personal case anyway. All right, I think I've... Mate, there's a bunch of questions we haven't got to, but I've taken screenshots of them. Maybe we'll save them.
Okay.
Because we've been going over an hour. I think we've done a good job today.
Yeah, I hope this is... Yeah. And
anything else vital?
Being relatively upbeat now, it's, you know.
Shall we end on a positive? Look, I've got someone asked, what do you like about each other?
I don't know. That's a bit.
Oh, come on.
You're looking very nice today in that black vest, showing off your tattoos and your.
I've started recording the videos of these, and so I might upload them as videos. It's a whole other thing to figure out logistically, but maybe in terms of editing. But come on, what do you like about me?
I told you I like your vest. I've known you since you were born. I like that continuity. You're sort of my family, aren't you, really? And you're very clever and good, and you make me look good because you're an Arab. Well, I'm never going to be...
I like you because you're very friendly and jolly.
Yeah.
And you're quite stoic and very generous. And good.
From time to time.
You're good as well.
My default position, though, has always been... Anyway, it's always, you're never going to get a serious answer from me, or it's unlikely, because my default position is to resort to humour, isn't it? Form of avoidance, but, you know, there you go. It's made me rich and famous.
Thank you for all the questions, everyone.
Yes, thank you. People say we love you. We don't love you, but
we love the idea of you.
Yes, we love the idea. Maybe we do love you. Maybe we, you know, the community of people who listen to my podcast is maybe, you know, I certainly feel tremendous affection towards you.
Yes.
You're the best of the best people in the world, in a way. People who listen to my podcast, I think.
I'll post links to all the gigs you mentioned, upcoming gigs, in the description of the podcast, and also to our Patreon. We love everyone on the Patreon. We love them.
I love you. Give me money.
Mm-hmm. All right, signing off.
I remember a friend of mine, it was a psychologist. She said one of the books that had been written about relations was "I Hate You, Don't Leave Me." Was the title of the book, which I thought was... I don't know why that...
I was in a musical once called "I Love You, You're Perfect, Now Change." Similar idea, isn't it?
Yeah.
I have to say, actually, I'm so moved and grateful for all the outreach about the last episode with Ben McIntyre. I've never seen so many comments and messages about one particular episode, and people have just been really sweet about my dad and about hearing about dad. And I'm very touched, and I really appreciate and love all the people who reached out and said something nice about dad. A couple of them would love to hear more about him, maybe in the future. that's why I know Alexis, through my dad, and, I'm just very touched. A lot of people reached out and they
said, "That's nice. He's a nice man."
Saying they were honored to hear his story and they would love to hear more and stuff like that. And I'm very lucky that he was. So, thank you, everyone who reached out about that. Sorry, I didn't mention it earlier, but there you go. Yeah.
All right. Are we done here?
I think we might be done, yeah.
Oh, bye bye, everybody.
Finish with a bang. There we go.
Bye bye. Oh, fucking podcast, isn't it? You've been listening to the Alexis L podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.